Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any absolute appeal to authority. Our guest today is Gavin Haynes, a freelance journalist, writer, presenter, and former editor-at-large at Vice. He's here to talk to us about the purity spiral, how a process of moral outbidding is corroding communities from within. Hello, Gavin. Welcome to the Middle Way Society podcast.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Okay, well, perhaps you could begin by telling us a bit about your background, Gavin, and how you first became interested in the topic, how you came up with the term.
I'm a freelance journalist, you might say. I worked for Vice magazine for a long time. Before that, I wrote about music. And I've often written about politics and sort of alternative politics, if you will. Vice is sort of very, very new media, and there's a kind of a beat around that. And the far right, I think, were a bit of a beat of mine at one point. And I pitched a documentary to Radio 4 about 18 months ago called Right Click, which was about, I guess, the new online right, sort of the classical liberal tendency, people like Sargon of Akkad, Carl Benjamin, Paul Joseph Watson and the likes. And this was a sort of a spiritual sequel to that. It's about the undergrowth of the internet. And I guess it's about something that we all recognize and have increasingly come to recognize is happening in specifically online politics. The term came before the examples. And it wasn't my term as such, but I sort of hermit crabbed inside it. The first known instance, I had to look this up the other week, was on an article on, I think, Slate in 2016. And it was used to refer to genuine sort of alt-right people, as in sort of, you know, racial theorists, not just sort of classical liberals. Getting inside the Republican Party. And there were another couple of instances in 2017 and 18 of people looking at, I think the most notable one was the Canadian music scene, which had fallen into a world of increasing sort of social justice madness. There was a band called Viet Cong who'd had to change their name. And they were that wasn't even good enough. They were then sort of still continually pilloried in the Canadian music press and sort of made persona non grata, gratia. And those were the sort of key instances that I drew on. But I added a kind of an undergirding of analysis to that. I liked the term purity spiral, and every time I said the term to someone, when I was like, oh, I'm doing this thing, they were like, oh, yes, what's that? And I was like, this is a winner. There's something in this that kind of chimes with the culture.
Okay, so what is it then? You know, could you unpack it for us a little bit?
a purity spiral is a process of moral outbidding unchecked, which corrodes a social group from within. That is the neatest nub of definition I've put on it.
Okay, and interesting. And you you say, you make the point that morality and purity are often confused with each other, but they are, you know, they're quite different things. Could you expand on that?
Yeah, well, as I see it, morality does not require a referent. You and I can be moral without interacting with each other, whereas purity is always something. You have to be purer than something. or someone normally. And that introduces the ratchet effect, which can, under certain circumstances, become a purity spiral. If the game becomes to be purer than thou, and that is how people are recognized within a social grouping. And the other distinction between morality and purity is simply what I've just said. It's the fact that ultimately the game is not about being good. The game is about achieving status within a community. But you would do that in a purity spiral through using the cudgels of morality, if you will.
So it's very much related to power then, and that power dynamics within groups.
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay. And would you say it has a political orientation, or do you find it right across the political spectrum?
It's an interesting question, because in the abstract, it has no political valence, because on the right, you see racial purity spirals, and indeed, the term it comes more from that. The alt-right have taken it up more and more to the notion that someone's granddaddy was not quite Aryan, or the distinction between being, say, Irish and being white. But more and more, what we recognize in popular culture is what happens on the left, where you have ideologies which are inherently prone to purity spirals. For instance, social justice ideology and its sort of philosophical underpinnings in critical theory, and especially critical race theory, where there is no clear sense of what purity means. It's an intransitive value, to use philosophers' jargon. That there's no single way that you could define it, because it has sort of multiple axes operating at the same time. So you're always going to have someone who is in a purer position than you, but you might also be in a purer position than them, and so on and so on and so on. So that feeding frenzy dynamic takes hold very easily, and we recognize that more and more, I think most people do.
Okay, so I mean, I suppose we often, as it's often associated with religion, purity, but you're saying you can find it within every field of human experience. So you're not a pure enough communist, or you're not a pure enough Aryan. I've noticed, I've heard actually that people who have conservative values tend to use the words like sick, like for example, Donald Trump, he uses the word sick and disgust a hell of a lot more than the average person, and I think there's a trend there. But I mean, but I suppose if you're from a more progressive side of the political spectrum, then your purity value kicks in if there's a polluted river at the end of your garden or something like that as well. So it's a universal value, presumably, that we all share to a lesser or greater degree.
Yeah, I mean, we all have, I guess, a disgust mechanism, so that is some sort of a sense of purity. And from what I understand, that people on the right have more of that sort of gag reflex, and have more of an urge to categorize things, to put things into boxes, and sort of say, well, the twain shall meet. At the same time, though, there is a similar tendency on the left to view morality as a kind of a zero-sum game. What's quite interesting in modern times is the on the whole, and I guess the underpinnings of that are the fact that people on the right are quite happy to have their morality and to have other people opposing their morality, even though they probably think those people are idiots. Whereas on the left, there is a sort of a totalizing impulse to, you know, what morality is and whether people who differ should be platformed or even exist.
Exactly. Yeah. No, interesting. Okay. So let's move on to your documentary then, Gavin. So, which you you did recently for Radio 4. So, you focused on two seemingly innocuous types of activity where the phenomenon has recently occurred. But you say that in some ways you wanted to you wanted to join the psychological dots between history's pinnacle nightmares and just what happens at the end of the road. So you presumably that's why you chose those examples.
Yes, and when you have the example, the two examples were knitting and young adult novels, and knitting obviously was just so perfect in terms of sculpting that contrast. You know, again, just I'd sort of tell the story of, well, I'm working on this thing that's about people in knitting furiously cancelling each other in this sort of orgiastic sort of violence. You know, it's such a great version of that that the point illustrates itself perfectly. And you know, I stand by that intro. I do think there is, obviously it seems hyperbolic, but there is something in that, because the whole time I was reading through these Instagram posts of various knitters who were denouncing others, I just kept thinking of reading Wild Swans about 20 years ago, you know, the novel, the memoir about China under Mao. And the idea that of people, you know, going out to the market square and denouncing their own parents for, you know, crimes of the four olds. I think we're all vulnerable to that to some extent. And it's just, yeah, it just seemed absolutely obvious to me that societies, that there is a great deal of groupthink in the world, and most people are not brave enough or independent enough to overcome that. And the deeper I traveled into the knitting world, the more that hunch was confirmed to me that it's very, very hard for people to lift their head from the trough of what's happening around them, that they might have good intents, et cetera, but reality is a consensual activity. And, you know, few and far between are the people who actually have, I don't want to say principles, that sounds almost quite patronizing, but who come at the world every day from a sort of a first principles approach and aren't simply swept up by a kind of availability heuristic.
Yeah. Well, they were two great examples how this thing can actually, as you say, spiral out of control in a sense. Could you just perhaps give us, for the listeners, an overview of one of them and what happened and how it was so toxic?
Yes, in the shortest way possible. I should perhaps mention Catherine Jebson Moore here, who was the Quillette writer who first uncovered this, or at least brought it to the public's attention. And she's a woman from Edinburgh who knits and just became fascinated by this and wrote a series of articles about it. The trouble starts, the timeline starts with a man called Nathan Taylor, who is known on the web as Sockmatician, a portmanteau of socks and mathematician. He knits socks and he has quite a mathematical mind. And he starts another portmanteau, Diverse Knitty, which is a hashtag which aims to get more people to talk to each other across sort of racial and other lines, because he has realized that he only really knows white knitters, and he's, you know, he's a man of the left, of the deep left. He's a gay man from North London. His husband is active in the Labour Party for many years, and this hashtag becomes a bit of a sensation in the world of knitting. 17,000 instances on Instagram, and people take it up, and people start to tell, you know, interesting stories, the sort of thing you might want, where people talk about being followed around knitting stores if they're black and they can't quite work it out. And, you know, perhaps they mark instances where they've lost work and it's not quite clear why, and so on. But as this process evolves, the most ardent voices become the loudest voices, because I guess in a social media world, that's often where the content is, in sort of rather unipolar and strident opinions. Mm-hmm. And what doesn't then happen is someone stepping in and saying, well, hang on, this is a bit of a fuss about it, I think, because what happens when someone does that is that they are then shot down by the more strident voices. And they're often shut down using the language of white fragility, which is a sort of a very Maoist kind of unanswerable charge, whereby if you object to what someone is telling you about diversity issues and whiteness and why you are politically incorrect, well, your objections are simply an example of your white fragility and therefore can be safely dismissed.
So it's a bit like witches. If they were dunked, they were guilty if they floated, basically.
Exactly that, yes. It comes at us through history in various forms, but no one ever wrote a best-selling, number one New York Times best-selling book about the dunking of witches, unlike Robin DiAngelo's White Fragility, which is this text where this white woman actually spells all this stuff out to her audience. And that sort of became a bit of a seminal text within the knitting world. And again, so these sort of ideological roots are being bolstered by ideological documents. And a lot of this stuff emanates from just a handful of knitters, really, but their capacity to punch above their weight is bolstered by the dynamic I've just described on social media, and by, you know, the sort of the game theoretic sense that it's hard to stand up to people because the benefit is very small if you're just one person, and the cost is hypothetically very large. And in the world of knitting especially, it seems, and young art novels, it seems particularly vulnerable to this kind of takeover, because you have a world of small businesses. Most knitters, they don't sell enough product to earn a full-time living, but they have their little store and they get on. And what they're selling through Instagram is a sort of an interesting mix of the personal and the commercial. So they'll talk about stuff that's happening in their lives. They'll, you know, post their latest piece that they are knitting, and then they'll try and flog you some wool. And this is, you know, it's a nice little world in that sense. But if you say the wrong thing, if your opinion is not orthodox, then that can delete your business very quickly.
Delete your what? Sorry, I didn't catch that.
Your business.
Yeah.
And so to get back to the case in point, as this ramps up, there is then a kind of an inciting incident about 6 months after this hashtag was invented by Nathan Taylor, which is when a woman in America, who's sort of quite a famous knitwear designer called Karen Templer, who lives in Nashville, posts on her blog about how she's really looking forward to her upcoming trip to India. And, you know, ever since she was a girl, she's loved the bright colours of India. And, you know, for her, as a woman from shy woman from the Midwest who hasn't travelled much, going to India is going to be like stepping onto the surface of Mars. And initially, everyone just, you know, beneath her blog writes comments about how wonderful this all sounds. But then a couple of the comments start denouncing her for crimes of cultural appropriation, for comparing India to the Martian surface. And this then becomes a whole scree of denunciation. It gets fed back into the Instagram world, and suddenly, you know, Karen Templer is at the center of a firestorm, and ultimately has to recant. That is an inciting incident because it triggers a lot of other things. There's then a woman called Kate Davies, who is a, she's a knitwear designer, and she lives in Orkney. She has she lives in the Hebrides, I think, and she had a stroke at the age of 36 and then completely changed her life and moved out to the Hebrides and runs a knitwear company up there very successfully. And a woman called, who goes by the online name Sukrita, decided to post about how Kate Davies hadn't come out and denounced the works of Karen Templer, the woman from Nashville. And so Kate Davies then finds herself at the center of a firestorm that is so intense that she has to shutter her 75,000 follower Instagram channel, which is basically the front door to her business in the way I've just described. There's another woman called Maria Tuscan, who is not a terribly famous knitter in just outside Seattle. And she is hounded so badly that, the local knitwear shop at the end of her very small street decides that they will no longer sell to her. She has emails from her friends saying that they've decided to, turn Turk, that they're going to go denounce her online. And I don't think we actually had time to include it in the documentary, but, Maria was talking about how, she got an email from one of her friends and saying that her friend was going to denounce her that day, and she just sort of went to the bathroom and threw up. Then this trail keeps running over the spring, and in July of last year, Nathan Taylor, the man who started the hashtag, comes back into frame and decides that he will use his clout within the knitting world. He's sort of fairly famous, and he's a very lovely man. He's just bloody nice. to write a poem in support of real diversity, in support of not making the great the enemy of the good, and just, can we all be a bit more civil? Yeah. And so he writes this very twee poem, which is a sort of a series of further puns on diversity, and is completely hounded out of society for it, to the point where he has a nervous breakdown and threatens to kill himself and has to be admitted to Barnet Hospital. And I somehow stumbled into this, really only about a month Nathan had had his breakdown, and I was the first journalist he'd sort of let into his house. I left his house 3 hours later, really quite shaken at how things had gone for him and how affecting it had been to him, because I was just sort of under no illusion that I was dealing with someone who basically, you know, had a nervous breakdown and was sort of suffering from a kind of PTSD, who just, you know, his I think people talk in terms of the limbic system now, don't they, couldn't shut off, and he was just constantly wound up. And the extraordinary thing when you meet people like that, and I've met quite a few of them in the course of this scenario, is that they have this sort of attitude of like, you have to believe me, you have to, and I think that comes from, I guess, the point that I make, that reality is consensual, and once you have become the quarry, and it's incredibly affecting to the human spirit. And it's hard to know that until you've been at the center of that world.
Well, he says that, doesn't it? You know, very few people experience 20,000 people describing you as being evil. It must be horrific.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, I mean, it's a phenomenon that we're only really starting to document on a psychological level. Now that we have, you know, social media and the capacity to make purity spirals in very short order. I think on a basic evolutionary level, I mean, a lot of, sort of evolutionary theory is quite sort of calls for a great deal of speculation, but I would have said that, you know, again, just reality is consensual, and that the price of being a dissenter in a primitive society was often death. You know, I just think we're not really built for stepping out of line. We're built to get on, and we're built to take our cues from people up the chain of the status hierarchy. And, you know, I think we all have a sort of an inbuilt sense that there is a kind of a reality out there, and we learn about it through talking to other people, and we don't sort of build into our models that other people are often wrong and stupid. And history is littered with examples of this. And I feel like the next thing I'm doing for Radio 4, which I didn't talk too much about right now, but is going to be kind of more about panning back even further and looking at the phenomena of different types of groupthink. I was listening to Dominic Cummings's 2014 talk at the IPPR the other day, and he was talking about, you know, working in number 10 in the center of government, and how chaotic it was, and how, you know, you always think that in a sanctum, that somewhere in there someone will you know, open up a little door, and there'll be a room full of ninjas training, you know, that's sort of you know, a deep order at the center of seeming chaos. And his point was, guys, there is no room, there are no ninjas. And I guess so, it's our failure to recognize the full chaos of our existence, and the full limits of the tiny aperture through which we can know anything.
I can very much relate to that. What I found also interesting about the story of Nathan was that he wrote something further towards the end of this episode, which seemed to, you used the term, there was a twitch. He brought it round to some extent. So how did he do that? You know, this seems to be, because part of a greater question is here is, how do we counter it? What did he do to make a subtle shift there?
Yeah, well, he basically went quiet for about 5 months and was sort of hounded off of social media. But in November, I think, perhaps October of 2015, 2019, he released a 90-minute vlog to his YouTube channel entitled simply The Truth, where he laid out his side of the story for the first time. Because I think what happens in a lot of these situations is that the truth gets refracted. Get back to my point about, you know, what we can reasonably know versus what we're sort of expected to know in a hyper-connected society. You know, I think a lot of people had denounced Nathan on the basis of broken telephone. And Nathan ultimately countered that by just unpacking his story at sort of extraordinary length. And the worm turned, things changed for him in the course of about 2 weeks after that. He got a lot, suddenly got a lot of orders through his web store, which ultimately made up for all of the money he'd lost in cancelled work. And it did appear that there was a fight back underway within the knitting community. Someone, another knitter who actually previously been in a cult as a child, started a hashtag called hashtag dismantle the knitting cult. And additionally, Maria Tuscan, the other knitter I've referred to there, has released a series of rules now called things like, actually one of them is called Purity Spiral, I'm honored. Another one's called Trigger Warning, and so on and so forth. And she's also trying to fight back in, a slightly more pugilistic way. And I'm not quite sure what the full status of the equilibrium is within the knitting community. I've had a few emails from people who hate me within the knitting community. It doesn't seem like all these people have rolled over, but it does seem like some of them are on the back foot now. It's very interesting because I spent a long time trying to contact anyone from the opposing perspective. I spoke to, you know, the what would you call them? The protagonists, maybe, the people like Nathan and Maria and so on. But the people who had denounced them, who you would have thought had an awful lot to say, and were certainly, you know, spending most of their days online saying an awful lot of things, talking social justice in minute terms, did not wish to talk to me in multiple emails and infinite channels of communication with people like Lorna Hamilton Brown, who, you know, has an MBE and is a regular Radio 4 guest talking on subjects of diversity and knitting, you know, refused point blank to countenance me. You know, Stephen West, perhaps the world's most famous male knitter, again, did not wish to dip a toe into these. You can kind of see why, but also, you know, if you're not prepared to make your case to the BBC, I have to wonder about the psychology of that. I have to wonder about what your case is and how confident you feel in it, let's just say.
Yeah. Okay. I'm just wondering, you know, back to the phenomenon itself, and that to some extent we're perhaps all prone to it. How can we work on ourselves to, you know, to minimize or mitigate the rising of it?
That's a very, you know, big question. I mean, I think in terms of the online world, I spoke to a man called Tima Karan, who is the father of something called preference falsification. And he has done some work around this sort of stuff. And he made one very interesting suggestion, which is that, you know, our social media simply aren't set up to prioritize these kinds of communication. And over time, we might well see a natural but gradual drift towards communities which are curated, which have what you might call a Leviathan or an element of civilizing core, someone, you know, a kind of a policeman to keep people on track, a chairman, if you will. So at a sort of a small scale and practical sense, that is one interesting suggestion that popped out of the box. Other, you know, broader things have to do with recognizing that this is happening. And I like to think that my documentary was a small contribution to that. And certainly the term Purity Spiral, it's been a delight to see it turn up more and more in the mainstream media as though it's a thing now, and to have given the world what I would term, you know, cognitive Lego. It's if you can name a thing, then you can understand it. And I think it's interesting. We've had a decade of people, you know, creating terminology which has done well, various impacts in the world, but, you know, words like mansplaining or whatever, that try and point to a thing. And it's the power of terminology cannot be underestimated. And I think the sort of critical theory social justice world has weaponized that quite effectively. It's about time the rest of us got in on the game.
It's a question I always ask all our interviewees. The middle way, as we understand it, is the idea that if you avoid absolute or fixed positions on things, both positive and negative, that throws you back into the messy, uncertain world of experience. But it's arguably in that messy, uncertain world that we can perhaps get to grips more adequately with the phenomena that we encounter, whatever they are. So how might that relate to what we've been talking about today?
I think that's a great way of summing up what we've been talking about today. I mean, you know, I think that's sort of basic psychotherapy too, isn't it? It's the idea that, well, there are things in the world, but we don't know, and we have to be humble before our lack of knowledge, and, you know, trust that we are feeling beings and we can negotiate a way forward by dialogue with others in the world. And, you know, you don't have to be a master's student in politics to know that the worst outcomes come from people trying to lay a lens over the world and negotiating from the map rather than the territory. You know, people will hide behind things which are held to be universal goods, and not recognize that nothing is entirely universal. You know, both oxygen and water are poisons in by dose. And, you know, you have to, the whole modern world is just crying out for people who are prepared to talk in nuanced terms. And, you know, I think the other thing that I guess is something that really gets my goat is the debates about immigration and sort of cultural assimilation and things like that. And we have such a sort of a perverted and corroded debate around those issues, because there's a whole sort of side of the modern left, especially, that refuses to imagine or acknowledge that there are logical limits to all of these concepts. And yeah, as you say, there has to be a way of returning our world to accepting that nuance is possible. And our politicians are not getting there. They are so infantile. It's not even funny. The debates before the election were sort of horrifically infantile for very similar reasons. Yeah. And my proposition just put out there is that rather than having these debates, I would love to hear both leaders extemporize for 30 minutes on a major topic. I'd like to have, you know, nine-minute interview where there are only three questions, because that to me seems like the point at which you really do reach down and find out something about these two men or however many humans and their worldviews. Because we don't even get to first principles. You know, one of the reasons I became interested in my last documentary, in Right Click, was because I realized that there were all these guys online who were, you know, digging into Hobbes and Locke and sort of deep philosophical first principles of politics, and then combining that with the sort of ultimate ephemera of the culture wars, whereas the people on the Today program were doing neither of those things.
Yeah. Well, that's a great idea, Gavin, about giving political heavyweights, well, any politicians, just real space to actually put their ideas across. Okay. Last question. So, if people wanted to find out more about your work, Gavin, how would they go about it?
Well, I guess maybe they should ask themselves if it's advisable. but I'm on Twitter as gav.haines. I have my own website, which is gavin-haines.com, which I occasionally update. I'm in the popular press. That's about the size of me at this point. I have designs on a newsletter, but watch this.
And any thoughts on a book about the Purity Sparrow?
Well, I mean, if you're working for Hachette Filipacci, do call my number. I mean, there are many, many instances. One is really not spoilt for copy in that sense. I guess the question is there something to say beyond that nice little nubbin? I mean, I think the documentary could have been a six-parter. Is that a book? Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah. Anyway, it's been absolutely fascinating talking to you this afternoon, Gavin. Thank you very much for giving up your time to speak to me.
Well, thank you.
You can find out more about Middle Way philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.